This is Living While Black, a statewide conversation on public radio stations across California. I'm Brian Watt, morning news anchor for KQED in San Francisco.
And I'm Aaron Bird, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, Los Angeles. You know, for a week now, our hearts have been heavy. We've been filled with all kinds of anxiety, fear, anger, as we've sat in front of our screens or marched in our communities in protest of the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
But all this heartbreak and the rage, all of the feelings, have been with us far longer than a week. Many of us would say for generations. And this conversation is our try at processing what it's been like for Black Americans in California.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, with that in mind, we definitely want you to join the conversation by calling us 866-733-6786. Once again, that's 866-733-6786. Or, of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org.
Over the weekend, throughout the state, we witnessed protests and unrest. Throughout the show, we want to hear from you. If you were out, why did you feel the need to be on the streets? If you were at home, what conversations are you having with friends, neighbors, family members? Our colleagues at CAP Radio in San Francisco were out over the weekend. Let's listen to some of the voices they heard.
What brings me out today is the injustice towards people who look like me. I'm a Black woman. I've grown up Black. I grew up in a military family, and my dad's really educated, yet when we moved back to the States, I remember the first time we were in SF and seeing him pulled over and harassed until he showed his military ID, and then suddenly he was treated differently. I'm here because I'm scared for my dad and my brother and my nephew, who is autistic, so he's at double the risk of being a Black man and being autistic because he doesn't always get the social rules and the social norms. I'm here too because I have some friends who are cops, and I don't think it is right that we are constantly defending officers who don't want to follow the rules, who don't want to be held accountable, and they're not being held accountable by those who work in the same department as them. We get angry about this, we call for change, and yet we move on to the next thing very quickly. And I'm here out of hope that maybe this time, maybe out of hundreds of years and centuries, maybe this time will be different. Maybe this time reform will actually happen. And we see it in Minneapolis where the riots happen and suddenly cops were fired, cops were arrested, and hoping that is, instead of becoming a surprise, that becomes the norm moving forward.
I went to college in the South. I've been pulled over. I've been detained for nothing. I've had neighbors when I lived in the South accuse me of domestic violence when I wasn't even home in the city. The violence that's going on is worrying me. The state of our society as it pertains to equality and equity for children is worrying me. And I think when I see it, I'm filled with anxiety and frustration and nervousness, which is why we're out here today. We're not giving our kids an equitable chance to reach their full potential. And I think that's related to police violence. It's related to the inequities in COVID. It's related to inequities in graduation rates and juvenile justice and everything. So we really do need systemic structural change for our children in this country.
The voices of Brittany Randall, Makaya Owen, Jasmine Ward, and Josh Coldwell. I want to turn to my colleague at KCRW, Aaron Bird. I need to ask you what the weekend was like for you, and just how are you doing? How is Santa Monica, Los Angeles?
Me personally, it was a tough weekend. The first word that comes to mind is visceral. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, and seeing all of what's been going on across the country, the thing that immediately came to mind is my memory of being around and present and being old enough and aware of what the riots meant in 92. And I haven't felt this feeling over the weekend since that time. My heart's been heavy, only matched by, honestly, a feeling of defeat and fear. I think that echoes the sentiments of a lot of people here in L.A.
I remember interviewing people about their memories 10 years after 1992, and reliving that for me has been very, very difficult. But I'm also at home in Oakland with two kids that I don't really know how to talk to about that. I'm hoping that during this conversation that we've got going here, we can learn. My kids are 8 and 3, and I do not know how to tell them about what's going on. And I'm hoping, and you don't have kids, but I imagine that it's something you're thinking about too, Aaron.
Not only is this something I'm thinking about, but I vividly recall having that conversation. I think every, especially black man, has had that conversation with their parent at one point in time. And I remember it being around the riots. And at that time, I was 10 years old. So that time is quickly approaching for that conversation with you and your kids, too. And hopefully, you know, during this time, you know, we obviously aren't going to have all of the answers, but hopefully we can create a little bit of a map and direction for people to process what is going on, healing, understand the origins of it, and also perhaps give some of the tools to have some of those conversations with their kids.
All right, let's go first to Reverend Shane Harris. He's with the People's Alliance for Justice. It's based in San Diego, but we are connecting with him today in Minneapolis, where he is visiting with the family of George Floyd. Reverend Harris, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Appreciate you inviting me, unfortunately, under these circumstances.
Well, I understand. We need to know, since you are there, you have been visiting with the family of George Floyd. How are they doing, and what have you done today?
Well, there's been several things that are going on. The People's Alliance for Justice, the organization I lead, is a national civil rights organization. We are based in San Diego. Our affiliates across the country, and I'm here with some of ours in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I think it's very important to note that the family of George Floyd has privately and publicly been calling for us to be strategic about our protest and be strategic about where we are trying to go with this movement. And so I have been with the family. I was with Terrence Floyd today, the younger brother of George Floyd, and have spoken with other family members and the family attorney, Ben Crump. I've spoken with family attorney Ben Crump, and we are announcing over the course of the next day a $2,000 contribution from our organization, a donation to the family for funeral costs or whatever needs that they have. But we really want to make sure that they have the support that they need, both financially and on the ground in the fight for justice.
What did the family tell you? Have they been able to learn any more about what happened to George Floyd?
No, I mean, they are still appalled that it has happened. They are in shock in regard to what is going on in response to it, all of the things going on. And honestly, they are trying to process exactly where to go. We have things that we worry about as far as what does the future hold for reform of these injustices that happen across the country. They are worried about their own family and how to bring everybody together and how paying for funeral costs and paying for personal costs and all of the things that are going on, the family members trying to come together, where the memorials and the funerals and all that is going to be. So they are overburied with everything that is going on personally and then still having to process this in public. It just must be extremely challenging and painful. I can't even imagine. Never have felt that before. And it's just I've seen it with other families of the brutality, Stephon Clark in Sacramento and Alfred Alongo in San Diego. I've seen families go through this, but I'm telling you, this is something I've never seen before, this national movement, this international movement, in the way that it's never happened before for George Floyd and for justice for all the lives lost to police brutality in this country.
Reverend Harris, this is Aaron Byrd from KCRW in Santa Monica. You know, you spoke to something that I think is an important point to highlight. I myself try as best as possible to avoid watching the videos of these murders. In this day and age, it's impossible to turn on a TV to open up social media without seeing what happened to George Floyd. I wonder if from your perspective as being a spiritual and community leader, if you can speak to the multiple relentless levels of trauma that a family endures having to relive that tragedy over and over again.
Well, I tell you, I have worked with several families across the country, and it's something I will continue to do because I believe my ministry is to be there for those who feel unheard and voiceless and those who would be left behind. And I'm telling you, these families are left behind on a regular basis. They are the last people that we think about, and they are the first people we run to because we want a story. But the pain of these grave injustices run very deep. You're processing a death, number one. Number two, you're processing it in public. And number three, you're processing it with the moral incompetence of our government systems who often don't want to provide equal justice under the law. We have to ask ourselves, why did it take this district attorney, Mike Freeman, the district attorney of Hennepin County, 5 days to figure out, or 4 days to figure out what we all saw, which was that he had probable cause to charge and arrest these officers, all of them. And it took him 5 days to just get one when he had probable cause from the beginning. So this family, like other families I've seen go through this, has to wait for the process privately, struggle with the fight for justice like everyone else, and then have to deal with the cost of burials and funerals. It is, I can't even imagine. And I appreciate you asking the question because the media always is the first to run their family, get the breaking story. But we forget that there's a long-term pain that results from moments like these for these families. And we must stand with them all the way when the cameras are there and when the cameras are gone, because they are the ones that are suffering the greatest hurt and pain through all of this, greater than anyone.
All right. Reverend Shane Harris with the People's Alliance for Justice based in San Diego. Thanks so much. Please stay safe out there. This is Living While Black, a special conversation on public radio stations across California.
This is Living While Black, a statewide conversation on public radio stations across California. I'm Aaron Bird, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, Los Angeles.
And I'm Brian Watt, morning news anchor for KQED in San Francisco.
For the next part of our conversation, I think it's important that we talk about race relations in policing specifically. Like, how do we handle this relationship with the police and responses to policing over the weekend?
We've seen police aggressively respond to protesters with violence in many cities, and in some we've seen police chiefs joining community members in taking a knee or marching with them.
But of course, overall, there remains an incredible lack of accountability and trust when it comes to policing, particularly when it comes to Black people and communities of color. We're going to talk about, and we want you to join the conversation, I would say specifically if you are Black, by calling 866-733-6786. You can also tweet us at KCRW or email us at form@kqed.org.
And we actually have a caller on the line, Cleveland in Stockton, California. What would you like to add to the conversation? Let's get started. Cleveland, are you with me?
No, this is Sean.
Sean, I think you're in Berkeley. I'm trying to follow along here. Tell me what's on your mind. Tell us what's on your mind.
I can't help but wonder, in our world, there seems to be a lot of isms. We have problems with racism and sexism and socioeconomic isms and politicisms, and they all seem like they're different heads of the same monster, and I'm just wondering what the root cause is, or what's creating all these inequities in our society for all people.
That is a very, very good question. Aaron, do you want to kind of help us sort of brainstorm on this? We do have some other people we're turning to for some thoughts on this, but This is all very hard to process.
Hey, absolutely. First of all, I would say, Sean, I understand the sentiments behind that statement and sort of the general bewilderment. We first of all don't have enough time to break down all of the nuances as to the origins and genesis of all of the isms. But the absolute most distilled version of the answer is there is a lack of love and a sense of equity. That's where it all stems from. Should we bring Alicia Garza into the conversation now?
Yes, let's bring Alicia Garza into the conversation.
All right, so just to let the audience know, joining us now is Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter and principal at Black Futures Lab. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you for having me.
I guess first and foremost, the most appropriate question is, emotionally, how are you doing?
I am here. I'm hanging in there and really stressed and sad and worried about the future of this country.
I want to know how you have processed what you have seen. There has been a lot to take in from the actual video, if you could watch it, of the death to the scenes of people protesting, but also scenes of damage being done to businesses. Where are you sitting in all of that, Alicia? How are you explaining it to people? How are you sitting with it yourself?
Well, there's a few things that I think are important to be mindful of right now. A week ago, we were talking about what it was going to take to make sure that we get justice for George Floyd, for Breonna Taylor, for so many families who have lost their loved ones to police violence and racial terror in this country. And, you know, after 7 years of doing this work under Black Lives Matter, I can honestly say that there are some very familiar patterns here that we have to figure out how we break ourselves out of. One of those patterns is we are so easily manipulated into changing the conversation about what justice looks like into who's a good protester and a bad protester. And it's something that we've been dealing with since the last period of civil rights. I can guarantee you that when people were marching in this country, either in the 1960s, or today, that there were always these conversations about good protesters and bad protesters. But what we lose in that conversation is the discussion about what needs to change in this country to ensure the dignity and sanctity of Black lives. The reality is Black communities are under attack, and whether it's by police violence, vigilante violence, or the violence of not having what you need in relationship to housing, healthcare, jobs, education, and the like, we cannot afford to keep having these shallow conversations about good protesters and bad protesters, broken windows over broken necks. Here's what I know. What I know is that we are more than a week out, and there still has not been enough movement on the investigation into the four officers who helped to kill George Floyd. There has been an autopsy that was released that is embarrassing in relationship to what it tried to communicate. The official autopsy said that it was not conclusive that George Floyd died from violent asphyxiation, but of course, an independent autopsy that was released today by the family shows that it absolutely was that. We were willing to accept quietly an idea that George Floyd could have died from asphyxiation, but he also could have died from heart disease and hypertension, or he also could have died because of substances that were allegedly in his body. We know better and we have to do better. It's high time that we stop asking these questions that we actually already know the answers to. Right now, in cities across the country, more than 60% of our budgets are being directed to policing that is not only not keeping us safe, but it is not being accountable to the citizens that it is supposed to protect and serve. That's a fact. In my community, in Oakland, California, the overwhelming majority of our city budget goes to policing. However, we also are one of the cities across the country that pays out the most amount of money to families who have lost their loved ones from being killed by the police. So my plea to everyone listening right now is this. There are things that we can do right now, and there are things that we can do over the long term, and all of it involves changing the rules that have attacked Black communities for decades. One of those rules is that police are, by and large, not held accountable when they commit crimes in our communities. That has to change. And who can change it in your neighborhood is your mayor, your police chief, and your district attorney. Over time, we also have to continue to fight to change the rules that keep Black communities under attack because we don't have the things that we need to live well. These are not rocket science answers. They take political will, and they take an ability for us to stop doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Police violence in this country is a trend and it's a problem, and we cannot continue to isolate it to incidents. We have to start taking action now.
Alicia, let me jump in and actually bring in another voice to this conversation. Brenda Stevenson, professor at UCLA. She specializes in the history of race and race issues in the United States. Welcome, Professor Stevenson.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a teaching moment, but a moment that you probably feel like we have been at before, at least other generations have. How are you thinking about this moment?
Well, this is a moment that's repeated across time and place in this country. And for Black people and other people of color, Indigenous people, Latinx people, etc., this is a moment that unfortunately no one is surprised by because it happens across every generation and it doesn't seem to be going away.
Right. And do we learn anything from history in this, in reflecting on how we have come through moments like this in the past?
What we've learned is that we need to do more, and we need to do more systematically, institutionally, and publicly. The public discourse and the public imagination around race and policing has to change dramatically. We need to have it needs to be very, very clear to people in our society what is clear to people of color in our society, which is that the legal system, the justice system in our nation is not an equitable one. And we have the power to change it, and we need desperately to do so.
Okay. I'd like to, there's a caller on the line who's been very patient, one of the leaders in yesterday's protest in San Francisco named Don. Don, you're with us now.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome.
Yesterday's protest was really powerful. Daytime protest started at 3 o'clock at City Hall. All was well. We ended around 6. And then other individuals came from out of town who were not interested in our cause, but self-enrichment. So that's what happened yesterday. And the leaders yesterday had no responsibility for any of the damage that was caused. As a matter of fact, as we went around through San Francisco, we talked about the various sites we stopped at. We stopped at Twitter. We stopped at Salesforce. Because our problem is not just the police are systematic. It's those who keep them in power. Police get 40% of our budgets. Wow, what do our children get?
Right.
So we're fighting systematic change. And, we're tired of just being labeled as criminals. I mean, Mr. Floyd, who's to say that somebody didn't give him that $20 bill, that he was an innocent victim?
I understand, yes.
But instead, he got arrested and then executed for something he may not even have known he was involved in. And then the root problem is when racism gets weaponized, like we saw in the park in Central Park, And see, I understand all these things because they've all happened to me. I have a complaint against the South San Francisco Police Department just here during the pandemic. You need five cars to stop me to give me a ticket for a taillight out? It's ridiculous. They chased me down without even that being the thing.
Right.
Apparently, someone called in and said, oh, there's a suspicious man in my neighborhood, when I was just doing my essential job.
Don, I want to go back to what you said at the beginning, talking about how your protest was peaceful. You were very, very happy with it. But you feel as if after a certain hour, there were people who were not a part of your group, not a part of your crowd, who took it over. Can I ask Brenda Stevenson if this has been a problem in protests in the past, that, you know, damage being done in other parts of the city or near a protest that has been peaceful, if this is, been a problem?
Yes, it has been a problem. I mean, you'll find always a group of people who, a small group of people, though, who are interested in other kinds of things, but also people who feel as if things are owed to them as well because our society has failed them. But you will find, you know, people who have a very well-formed and informed political mandate in their protests, and other people less so, who then come in and also will take advantage of some of the opportunity to gain private enterprise for themselves. But I also want to say that it's important, this young man who was just speaking, it's very important to understand that the people who were involved in the protests nationally have made it very clear that they have been anti-violent. They're against violence. They're for peace. And they have very well-formed and informed political agenda that's important to relieving this essential problem within our nation, and they're working towards that. But we do see this happening regardless of whether we're looking at the 1960s, whether or not we're looking at the 1990s, whether or not we're looking at now, where we have an element that will come in sometimes, most times, not directly related to the political organizations that are calling for the protest, and this happening, and that being used to undermine the political, the real importance, the moral importance of the protest itself.
Yeah, I wonder if I can jump in, Professor Stevenson, and maybe directly ask Alicia, actually, in regards to what Don is experiencing and what Professor Stevenson just spoke to. I wonder if you have any advice or tactics that you suggest to protesters that encounter individuals that obviously are trying to co-opt the situation, as we've seen in many cases here.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few things. One, I think it's important to recognize that there are a lot of people who join or who organize protests. It's important to know who you're rocking with. And as somebody who has been a part of protests and organized actions in this area for 20 years, I can tell you a lot of us know each other. We know, you know, the folks who want to use different tactics, but we also know each other. And so if there is something being organized and you don't know who folks are, it's best to try and participate in a different way. Here's the other thing I'll say, and the caller was absolutely right. You know, it's important when you see protests or you join protests. Organized protests have clear demands. And so this idea that we went to Twitter and we went to Salesforce and we talked about why we were there, that is something that is important to look out for. But again, let me say this. I know that there is a lot of concern happening right now. And one of the things I really want to make clear for all of us is that we have to address why it is that people are in the streets in the first place. And until we do that, and until we do that with some authenticity, with integrity, and with clarity, we are going to continue to see a lot of what we're seeing right now, which unfortunately, in many cases, is being infiltrated by people who do not have an anti-racist agenda. And in fact, their agenda is, in some cases, not all,
but in some cases, their agenda is to use us as cover to move what I would call is a racist agenda. So there's that. Last thing I'll say here is that there are some clear and concrete things we can do. We need to make sure in the context of an upcoming election that this does not just become fires and broken windows across the country. We can and must do better to push and hold elected officials accountable for the lack of action that we have seen from coast to coast. My organization, the Black Futures Lab and the Black to the Future Action Fund, put out a Black Agenda for 2020 in February, a comprehensive plan that has steps for what we can do policy-wise right now to change the rules, to make Black communities powerful in every aspect of our lives. It is incumbent upon us to continue to demand rules change in this country, and that's one place to start.
Want to thank the callers and our guests for joining us. We're going to go to a break now. We're actually going to talk to a voice from the police when we come back. This is Living While Black, a conversation on public radio stations across California. This is Living While Black, a conversation across California public radio stations. I am Brian Watt at KQED in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And I am Aaron Bird, a DJ at KCRW here in Southern California, Santa Monica, Los Angeles.
We are now joined by Rob Harris of the Los Angeles Protective League. Mr. Harris, we needed to hear from somebody. We have heard a lot so far in this conversation about the police's role in this, and I wanted to hear from you. First of all, can you talk about how the protests have developed in Los Angeles and how the Protective League has managed them?
Sure. I think the protests, as everybody knows, were spurred on by what the nation and the world saw coming out of Minneapolis. And rightfully so, you saw police chiefs from across the country. You saw some of the large police unions representing rank and file come out and condone the actions that we all saw in Minnesota. And so that incident itself spurred people on to take to the streets to exercise their right to protest in a peaceful way. And then what we have seen is other individuals hijack that right to exercise their own agenda of vandalism and destruction.
Aaron, do you have a question? You were there in Los Angeles, and I know that you've been living it. Do you have a question?
I do. Well, first of all, I want to know, first of all, thank you for joining us. And secondly, I would like to know, are you a former officer yourself?
Yes, I am a 20-year veteran with the Los Angeles Police Department, and I am also a U.S. Army veteran.
You know, obviously, the role of the state and the police play a central role in what's going on now in this particular climate, and has been for quite some time throughout the history of this country, in fact. Though I know you can't speak to any particular individual's actions, certainly not ones all the way over in Minneapolis, but we've seen time and time again over the years with these incidences, there are fellow police officers literally standing by, arm in arm, sometimes protecting the brutality that is being exacted upon these helpless individuals. I think for myself personally, I would really like to know from a police officer, there seems to be some sort of system in place where there is a code to stand by and allow those type of actions to occur. If I'm wrong, I would love to hear why. And I would also love to hear, and I think many of the listeners would as well, would love to hear, why do we see that time and time and time and time again in so many of these videos?
Yeah, okay, so that's a lot to unpack in an answer. I think where I would start would be anytime we speak in broad generalities. I think we do a disservice to the conversation, and I think we undermine the ability to reach solutions or to reach understanding. And I think appropriately, we've seen the media and journalists and shows like this differentiate protesters from the vandals, the looters, and the rioters, and rightfully so. I think when we have a conversation about policing in America, I think we should resist the temptation to say that this is completely systemic. We have a million police officers in this country, and I have worked Los Angeles for 20 years, and I have personally never witnessed anything that would equate to misconduct on the part of an officer or anything that would be considered outside the law. What I have seen is officers who have dedicated their lives to improve the communities that they come from. Does that mean that it does not happen? Absolutely not. But when we have a conversation about how do we improve the relationship and rebuild that trust, I know Los Angeles Police Department has been working on that for decades. I know that our department is at the forefront of building relationships and helping the communities to understand what we do and why we do it and how do we improve. And I would also add on there that anytime we have a conversation about trying to change collectively, it begins individually. And it begins with exercising effective leadership and looking at the decisions that you've made and then owning mistakes, owning failures, owning where mistrust has happened, and then trying to work to overcome that. And in doing that at a table where emotion isn't running the conversation, but reason is there to temper that emotion, that's really when you start moving towards a solution or resolving problems. So the Los Angeles Police Protective League, we have been at the table many times with a variety of groups to discuss issues like that so that we can begin to keep that trust in place and to ensure that there is confidence in the police that are patrolling their communities.
And Mr. Harris, I, Brian Watt here at KQED in San Francisco. I used to live in Los Angeles, occasionally a California stop, meaning I got pulled over for rolling through a stop sign, even got stopped for jaywalking in downtown Los Angeles. I live in Oakland now. Every time anything of the nature happens to me, I get knots in my stomach. And I guess I want to ask you, and I know that this is not a simple answer, what am I supposed to do? I mean, we all hear, keep your hands on the steering wheel, don't reach for anything, things like this. But like, what would you tell me to do to de-escalate any potential for any situation?
I think it starts first with just listening to the instructions that are given to you by the officer. And you have to remember that in any public and police interaction, the goal should be mutual respect between the two. Does that always happen? No, it does not. But that should be the goal. And in doing that, it's listening to the instructions that the officers are giving. It is providing an environment where the officer is able to do what he needs to do without the situation escalating. And again, look, I understand that not every interaction with every single police officer goes that way, but that should be our goal. And I think it should be grounded in mutual respect for the two parties. I understand. Look, I've been pulled over by the CHP before. I get nervous. I think any time that you are about to have somebody of authority engage you, there is a little bit of concern there. But we also really want to, and this is for the Los Angeles Police Protective League, in specifically in the conversations we have, and it's really trying to understand the perspective and the perceptions of the communities that we serve. The perceptions that they hold about that traffic stop may be wholly different than the perception of the officer that's on the traffic stop. And if dialogue never happens, and if we are never able to walk each other through what those thoughts are, what those fears may be, then we're never going to understand each other. And so that's why we've had plenty of conversations with people about this.
I want to keep this Bay Area to Los Angeles conversation going and bring in a caller. Nathan is actually calling from Oakland, which is where I live. Nathan, what's on your mind?
Hi, how you doing today? Thank you for the answer. I was at a few of the protests over the weekend, and I guess the lack of organization is a pretty obvious precursor to misplaced anger. And we're seeing, like people have said, multiple groups of people. But activists over the weekend have also posted very clear things on how to stay organized. The activist Killer Mike, for instance, is posting tips on how Hong Kong is organized and how they have handled this, basically. And one point that is, I guess, that has been kind of going over that people have mentioned today is a clear list of demands. And I think that going forward, if we're going to continue to be outside and protest, and we need to have a clear list of demands. And I think one thing high on that list is to have not only the citizens demand, our own police officers and our own police department demand for the arrest of these people. Otherwise, we assume all of these cops are on their side. We sit and stand, watch them there in their full riot gear, standing without any word. And I can stand there and ask officers to raise their hand and say, who do you think, I guess, who's bold enough to say that this is wrong and stand out against your own people?
There's another caller from Oakland, and they're coming in a different sort of order. But I do want to hear from Jonathan. You are in Oakland while we're on the line with Mr. Harris of the Protection League. Jonathan.
Hey, my name is Jonathan. Yeah, I'm actually not in Oakland. I'm actually in San Francisco right now.
My apologies.
No, it's perfectly fine. So I'm a black man, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the gentleman for taking questions from people. So there are two things that I want to talk about. The reason I didn't go to the protest this go around is because I was in Baltimore after Freddie Gray was murdered in the back of that police van. And now here I am all over again in San Francisco and seeing the exact same things play out. And right after Freddie Gray died, I got a chance to talk with the president of the Fraternal Order of Police on NPR. And when I asked him that police officers being on the front line have the first experience of what's wrong with our community and that they should be the ones bringing the attention to what's going on because they wear a badge and people will listen. His response to me was, you need to take that up with your politician. He had absolutely no interest in solving the many issues that we face between black communities and the police. So there are two things that I'm realizing from that. The first thing is that mayors and politicians and our elected officials, they're not the ones kicking down people's doors and shooting women in the night. They're not the ones snatching people out of their cars because of an out taillight. They're not the ones that are thinking that someone is reaching for something in their pocket and killing them without even taking the chance to open up a line of communication. So what I have to say to the man that's on the line is this. There is a huge community of not only police that encourages behavior, but there's also a large community of people, Americans, who encourage this behavior, who drive around their cars with police stickers, who pretty much will almost impersonate a police officer just because it's a cult. The police culture has become a cult. And none of these police officers fear consequence. They don't fear being fired. They don't fear being arrested. They don't fear being reprimanded. They don't fear going to court. They don't fear anything because they have gotten off time and time and time again. So my solution is when you see these cops doing this, if you don't get them off the force, what's going to start happening is people are going to start killing these cops. And once that happens, it's a full-on war. Because right now, it's a massacre. A war is when people on both sides die. A massacre is when people on one side are dying. And if you don't want a war, you have to step in.
We need to hear from Rob Harris of the Protective League in Los Angeles. I want to make sure you get a chance to respond to that. I know it was a lot, but what's on your mind as you hear comments like that?
I acknowledge, obviously, the frustration that is his experiences. I'll go back to what I said previously, and that is we really have to avoid the temptation to speak in broad generalities. My experience with 20 years in this department is officers are very afraid of being disciplined and fired. It is absolutely true. I don't know, as a board member dealing with the rank and file officers and representing them and talking with them, there are no officers that I know of who want to come to work and be involved in a use of force. I've been involved in a use of force. I have suffered injuries. Those injuries still plague me to this day. I would much rather have gone through my career, solved problems, created relationships, left radio calls to go back home without ever having been involved in a fight. And this is what I think is missing in the conversation, is having people who are passionate and have emotion, but are tempering that with some reasonableness, so that when we sit at a table and we have a conversation, we can trade our perspectives and our perceptions. I think law enforcement has not been great at explaining what we do and why we do it. I know when I was young on the job, we really didn't take the time to explain to people what we did at a scene or why we did it. Why did we separate people? Why did we put one individual in the back of our police car? Why did we not issue a ticket? Why did we issue a ticket? But over the years, we have begun to get better at that. And like I said, Chief Moore said it earlier when he was live on the TV, we have come a long way in the decades since 1992 with our discipline process, our oversight, which is all civilian now, the transparency that we use. So we are making strides. Have we come far enough? I would say no. But we are not the only ones that should be vested in having this conversation. Because to be honest, when we look at our inner city communities or our minority communities, there are a lot of things that need to be addressed. But the easy path is to say, well, it's all on law enforcement. The law enforcement should not be the psychotherapists. We should not be the front line dealing with individuals suffering from mental health crises. We should not be the ones that are saddled with trying to be the counselors at the scene. That's not our role. And so the Los Angeles Police Protective League, we have actually, we belong to a coalition for the last 2 years where we have been trying to take a holistic approach to how we improve the communities that we serve by forming better economic and education opportunities, because we know that violent crime is tied to those things. So how do we begin to put apprenticeship programs and trades programs into our communities so that people can help themselves? See, once you give away your ability to have control over your own circumstances, you make yourself a victim, and that's a horrible place to be. And so what we would like to see is yes, go ahead.
No, I wanted to thank you. There's another guest we want to talk to, and really, really appreciate the points you're making. I just had to jump in. Rob Harris, the Los Angeles Protective League, thank you very much for taking the time to be part of this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
One of the conversations being had right now is about mental health and how we can be okay. We haven't even mentioned COVID-19, quarantine, sheltering at home. We've been trying to take care of ourselves already, but now we're dealing with this. Joining us now is Tanya Mosley, host of KQED's Truth Be Told podcast, also the Here and Now national radio show. And the last episode of Truth Be Told that is out there is actually about taking care of yourself. Tanya,
yeah.
It's good to hear your voice.
Brian.
It's always good to hear your voice.
Please help us, Tanya.
Oh, you know, I mean, what a conversation.
Yes, well, I hung on every word of this last episode of Truth Be Told. You have been talking to people all week on the radio, and just how can we take care of ourselves? I think that's how we should end this conversation today.
You know, I mean, that is, I think, a question that we're all grappling with and will continue to grapple with. But one thing about this latest episode that we did about Black men and mental health, it actually came from a listener who was thinking about his position as a Black man in America, a father, a spouse, and just coming to grips with some of the things that really weigh on your mind when you're living as a Black person in this country. And so we had several Black men on to talk about mental health. The thing about this this issue is that we could be talking about it a month from now, 5 months from now. We could have talked about it 5 years from now. It is still like the same issue that we are always grappling with. But one thing that I was left with our particular episode is that the means for caring for ourselves is how we've been able to get through tough times in the past. And so one thing that we really want to focus on when it comes to Black men is acknowledging the pain and the hurt that they're feeling and dealing with this. We often think that, you know, a man has to be masculine and has to be strong and can't really show weakness and can't really show emotion. And this show really tackled that.
Tanya Mosley, thank you so much for all your insight there. I would suggest that everyone download the latest episode of Truth Be Told. It certainly helped me as a black man. Aaron Bird, good listening in these times. We're trying to wrap up here now this hour-long conversation, special conversation. Aaron, thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who's called, everyone who's contributed to the conversation. And be safe, stay healthy. Thank you, Brian.
This is Living While Black.